And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're devoting the morning shows of early 2024 to some of our favorite programs from 2023. And today, I am happy to share two of my favorite interviews from last year, beginning with a conversation with a decorated war correspondent named Jane Ferguson, talking about her memoir, No Ordinary Assignment. In part two of today's program, you will hear the interview that I was privileged to record back in March with none other than William Shatner. Here's part one of today's program. I'm not sure there is any occupation on the face of the earth quite as challenging as that of the war correspondent. And certainly we get a taste of what that life is like from an extraordinary new memoir written by Jane Ferguson, an award-winning war correspondent. Her book is titled No Ordinary Assignment. And in this book, Jane Ferguson tells us about the harrowing experience that she has had all over the world, covering war and conflict in places like Yemen and Afghanistan and Syria and Somalia and the Ukraine. And it is a story that is told with bracing, unstinting honesty. And we get a sense not only of the incredible difficulty of doing this kind of work and also the importance of doing this work well, but we also are reminded again and again of the deepest consequences of war, the way in which war impacts in such a brutal way, not just the specific and official combatants in that war, but also the civilians, in a sense, caught in the crossfire. This is part of the story that she tells so well in her memoir, as she has told it in her award-winning work as a war correspondent. Again, the book is titled No Ordinary Assignment, a memoir published by Mariner. Jane Ferguson, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having me on here.
I'm really honored to be speaking with you. Your book tells us some interesting and difficult things about your childhood growing up in Northern Ireland. And I suspect that one of the reasons why you tell us about your childhood and what made it in so many ways a hard childhood is not just for the sake of kind of giving a complete chronicle of your life up to this point, but also because that surely has something to do with the kind of work that you have gone on to do and how well you have been able to do that work. Tell our listeners about growing up in Northern Ireland towards the tail end of what is sometimes known as the Troubles. Tell us what life was like and, in a sense, its lasting impact upon you.
Sure. I mean, I do think you hit the nail on the head there in terms of, like, why I would include so much deeply personal detail in my book, because I outline at the very beginning that I want to answer, in writing this book, the question that I'm asked all the time, which is, why would you do this kind of work? What makes people like you go out and do this? And when you really start to connect the dots backwards in your life, you know, it's personal, the way we live our lives, the choices that we make as adults. So much of that we can really trace back to our origin story and where we were when we were being formed and created. And so because I wanted to write a story about a person and not just about a career, I did have to dig very deep. And going back to Northern Ireland, I do talk about being a little girl growing up in a very, very rural Northern Ireland on a small farm in a family that was somewhat chaotic and in a sort of like tough environment there, and not really feeling like I fit in, feeling like a little bit out of place everywhere I was, having a lot of wanderlust at the wider world, you know, reading books and staring at atlases and just kind of absolutely really taken by the idea of going out into the wider world and exploring. But at the same time, I'm growing up not only within a sort of chaotic family environment, but also a wider conflict in Northern Ireland, as you have said, called the Troubles. Now, the Troubles, of course, I'm sure many of the listeners have some sort of understanding on the memory of of Northern Ireland in the 80s and 70s, the 80s and 90s when I was growing up there. The conflict had sort of started really in the 70s, this armed uprising against British rule by elements of the IRA, the Irish Republican Army. And I was growing up in effectively just outside of the last Protestant village before you got to incredibly wild IRA heartlands in South Armagh. So it was often referred to as bandit country down there. And you know, it's very hard for me to look back and not see this little girl on a farm filled with stories about how in the hills around us were IRA insurgents. That's certainly not a word we used back then. But then I find myself as an adult throughout so much of my life coming to try to understand insurgents. I spent a ton of my career really focused on understanding and spending time with insurgencies, whether it's Hamas or the Taliban or Hezbollah or rebels in Darfur. And I, you know, whenever you sit down to write your story, you do see these connections with your childhood. You know, and again, I write in the book that you really do think when you're a child, you tend to normalize everything. And I thought everybody drove through military checkpoints when they drove down the road. And I thought it was perfectly normal for military helicopters to land in your dad's field. So I was very much so growing up around this sort of insurgency violence in Northern Ireland, where there were assassinations. You know, write about this in the book, an assassination attempt on a family member of mine. And the impact that this conflict was having on individuals and families was playing out in front of me as a little girl as I was sort of becoming a person.
Hmm. And I know you also talk about sometimes being close at hand when the family and or friends were listening to the radio and to accounts from various war correspondents, and probably that planted a seed as well. You tell us that a post-college internship with the BBC didn't really end up leading to anything. But then your dear Aunt Fanny, someone who was a real provided for you kind of a place of refuge and a source of encouragement in those really difficult years of your childhood, gave you quite a generous check and told you to please use it for something fun. Explain to our listeners what you did with this check that you were given by your Aunt Fanny.
Well, it was Aunt Fanny was, you know, she was actually my great aunt's best friend. She was an honorary aunt in the family. It's very common culturally where I come from to call someone your Aunt Fanny. And she was someone, like you've said, who I spent all my, you know, so much of my summers at her house by the coast. And she was an elderly lady who'd really, you know, become a mother figure to me. And she had no kids of her own. She'd never married. And she was basically, you know, approaching a stage in her life where she was really keen to use her money to help the people that she knew around her, because, you know, she didn't have kids to leave her wealth to. And so she wrote me a check. It was £3,000, so about $4,500 at the time, and didn't say anything, just put it in the mail to me straight out of college. I just finished this internship, which I hadn't managed to get a job at the end of it. And she said to me, do something fun with it. And I had been dreaming of moving to the Middle East and traveling and learning Arabic and studying. And so that's what I did. I bought a ticket on Yemenia Airways to Sana'a, the capital of Yemen. And I registered at a school where there were lots of, a few other Westerners there studying Arabic. And I settled into that. You know, don't forget, this was sort of the start of a financial crisis. So finding a job in journalism was so incredibly hard. All of the newspapers were hemorrhaging money. Many of them were folding. The broadcasters that I'd grown up watching, like the BBC, where I dreamed of working, were having to lay off hundreds of staff. And so it was so hard to find any way into the industry. Every door was kind of shutting. And I really wasn't sure how I was going to make these dreams a reality. The only thing I'd ever really wanted since I was a little girl. And so when Fanny sent me that money, I realized that I could at least move forward. You know, so many times in my life, I haven't known how I'm going to move beyond that one point, but all I need is this one step in front of me. And so I took it and I flew to Yemen.
Hmm. I was going to ask, why Yemen? Why studying Arabic? Was it that was a place where you saw opportunity for yourself, or was there something else that was drawing you to that particular part of the world?
Well, I knew that I wanted to cover major geopolitical stories around the world. I've been drawn to those who tell stories from conflict zones. You know, these are stories that impact millions and millions of people. So, you know, 9/11 happened when I was still in high school in Northern Ireland. And so that's where so much of the news was coming from. And so I on the one hand, I knew that's where a lot of the war reporting was happening. But on the other hand, I'd also grown up reading, you know, books by British explorers and adventurers and people like Dame Freya Stark, and I'd been fascinated by both Africa and the Middle East as regions. And I had taken some Arabic lessons in college, but they were in classroom settings, and you know, it was very hard to learn without the immersive experience. And so a lot of when I did a little bit of research online, a lot of young people were studying in Beirut, Damascus, Cairo, or Yemen. And to be honest with you, at the time I had this one check from Fannie, and it was pretty much all I had in the world. And studying in Yemen was much cheaper than studying in the other cities. And I thought, if I go there, I can stay longer. And then when I looked into it, I realized how Yemen was so intoxicating and fascinating as a culture, much, much, much more off the beaten track for travelers. And that really, really appealed to me. It had its own extremely unique culture. So I was really drawn in.
We're speaking with Jane Ferguson, the author of No Ordinary Assignment, a memoir. Jane Ferguson, an award-winning war correspondent, and this book has just been published by Mariner. So you end up in Dubai and get a job as an assistant sports reporter, of all things, at the Gulf News. And it sounds like it was a happy, fulfilling life in some respects, and yet one which ultimately left you dissatisfied. Explain to our listeners the moment, in a sense, when the bubble burst and you realized this is not exactly where you wanted to be, or more importantly, not what you wanted to be doing with your life.
Sure. I mean, I had gotten a job in, you know, as the financial crisis had impacted so much of the Western world, it hadn't quite reached Dubai yet and the Middle East and much of the East yet. And so I got a job at a newspaper in Dubai, an English language newspaper, which was a sort of regional paper in the Middle East. And I had worked my way up. I'd been very, very fortunate to have been able to have these opportunities. I started, like you say, as a sub-editor on the sports section. I was, you know, basically fixing spelling mistakes and making cups of coffee and working shifts. And I'd worked my way up to being a business features writer, which was a great job, you know. I mean, to be 24, and I had a lovely life in Dubai. I had a beautiful apartment, and I had a sports car, I could see that I had a future as a business reporter in that part of the world, and I could see that it was something that was, I could see my life starting to unfold in that direction. And I write about in the book how one day I was at a car, a Mazda car dealership, where, you know, because it was part of my beat, I would cover any kind of, like, you know, industry trends in the region and in the UAE. And, you know, I just couldn't shake the feeling that, however comfortable and lovely this life was that I had been blessed with, it was absolutely not what that little girl on that farm in Northern Ireland had dreamed of. You know, I thought I was going to be off. I'd read about correspondents who had been off in Tiananmen Square when the attacks happened by the Chinese government. They were able to document that kind of history and really correct the record on what had happened. I thought that I would be in Afghanistan, you know, reporting on that country's attempts to really build democratic institutions. I just, I had pictured my life so differently, and I got this sort of sense of panic. Of course, I laugh at it now because I was 24 years old. I had this impatience that time was somehow running out. And I write about this, how I just couldn't, in that moment, I'm watching these cars and interviewing Japanese business executives, and I just think to myself, I can't wait another second, because I didn't go to an Ivy League school. I didn't have a particularly prestigious, I didn't have family with connections. I didn't know how to get from where I was to where I wanted to be. But I knew that if I just waited around, it wasn't going to find me. So I kind of had this instinct that I had to act. And I get in my car, and I drive to Dubai Airport, Terminal 2, which is where a lot of the regional flights go. And, you know, I asked around for, you know, where were the offices for the flights to, for the airlines that fly to Afghanistan. I booked a ticket. And I just knew that if I acted, if I did, again, if I could just do one thing that would push me forward, I would figure it out.
Well, figure it out, you ultimately did, of course. Right around this time, I think it was maybe shortly after you had purchased that ticket to Afghanistan and made your way there, but I don't think you had maybe yet begun your work as a war correspondent in earnest. You had the opportunity to meet someone who is something of a legend in the business, Tim Page, very well known for his outstanding work as a war photographer during the Vietnam War. And he gave you advice that you seem to have taken very much to heart, because really what he beseeched you to do has been a hallmark of your reporting ever since. Tell us about this encounter with Tim Page and what he advised you to focus on in the work that you were about to begin as a war correspondent.
Well, when I got to Afghanistan, the newspaper I was working with agreed to run some of my pieces from there, and so I basically just booked vacation time, paid for my own travel, and I was scrambling around in the first couple of days trying to figure out what to write, and I was such a rookie. I had no idea that it was Eid, which is the end of the holy month of Ramadan, and Eid is basically like showing up on Christmas Day and expecting to be able to work. And so I was struggling in the first few days. And someone who was a press officer at NATO, who had been staying in the same little hotel guest house where all of the journalists stayed, he had kindly advised me. He said, you know, the United Nations have Tim Page, they've flown him in, and he's training Afghan photographers and really helping build a media here, a sense of local Afghan media. And so he would be a great interview and profile piece. And I thought, that's fantastic. So I headed down to the UN in Kabul, and I met with Tim Page. And as you have said, I ended up spending several hours with this man, and he, and in what was meant to be an interview, just ended up becoming this unbelievable conversation of mentorship that I hadn't really even known that I needed. And he is an extraordinary character. He actually just passed away not too long ago. And I was very sad to know that I couldn't send him this book and let him know how he had been, you know, how it had this butterfly effect in my life and my career. And he sat down and he was very much so almost kind of like out of central casting. You know, he was dressed as a war photographer. He was smoking rolled up cigarettes and chatting and drinking coffee. And it felt like, it felt really, really like I was living in a sort of Hollywood movie. And he just, instead of answering, he'd answer my questions, but largely he would go off on very long soliloquies about how this work should be done and how we should focus on the real countries that we're covering, the people. And I know that sounds obvious now, but, you know, when you're a youngster who has these sort of dreams of being a war reporter, you can get kind of caught up in this idea, the identity of it and the coolness of it, and take a picture of me in my flak jacket and I'll have swashbuckling combat stories to tell. But he said to me, you know, you know, we have to put a human face on this war. And instead of saying these are the front lines you need to get to and these are the big battles in Helmand, he said, you know, why do we not go to insane asylums and talk about the mental health crisis here? Why do we not talk about, you know, why do people have these massive weddings and put themselves into debt to keep up with the neighbors? He said, we know so little about these people and their culture, and we're not really communicating it to the people back home. And he also complained that, you know, there wasn't enough reporting on how tough it was for the soldiers, for the American and British soldiers out there. And the room just filled up with story ideas that had never occurred to me. And I was fascinated. It occurred to me that this conversation I was having with him was what real journalism was about. And I had come having this idea that I'd be in a foxhole and I would be doing very glamorous bang-bang combat reporting. And in my career, I've done plenty of that. But he reminded me that I was there to report on a country and not a war.
Hmm. And how it affected the people there. So it's not just reporting on bullets through the air and bombs going off, but the cost of that war, the impact of the war on the people there. And beyond,
exactly.
And beyond the combatants, and of course, you have managed to do that in so many different places. Of course, you are doing this work at a time when war is waged in a very different way than it was a generation or two ago. Wars used to be fought in a way with battle lines very clearly delineated, and we're here, and the enemy is there. Just talk for a moment about the supreme challenge, not only for those who wage war and are directly engaged in war, but you and your colleagues trying to cover war in this new era, the way that it is so often fought.
It's definitely worth pointing out the different generations. You know, I was a little too young to be the immediate post 9/11 generation of war reporters who were going to Afghanistan and Iraq in those early days, and they were covering insurgencies and the battle against insurgencies, but with most often with military. So they'll be out on embeds with the American soldiers in Afghanistan, or the British soldiers in Helmand, or in Iraq. You know, so embedded and very often out in the fields with major militaries, or with the militaries of those countries, like the Iraqi soldiers or the Afghan soldiers. Now, of course, there were always some reporters who were managing to get deep right into the field. But generally, broadly speaking, in TV, that's what most journalists were doing. But then my generation really came along. I was just starting out before the Arab Spring started. And so this was a wave of revolutions across the Arab world in 2011 and 12, where dictatorships were being brought down by popular uprisings. And in many cases, dictatorships held on, or the vacuum was filled with warring parties. And so a lot of these initially peaceful revolutions turned into civil wars. And so my generation of reporters were actually used to spending time with the insurgents. Suddenly we're shoulder to shoulder reporting with, Syrian rebels, or, you know, heading into Yemen and spending time with Houthi rebels. And so across the same in Libya for many reporters. And so that was very much so our challenge as well. On the one hand, incredible access, but on the other hand, you're with the underdogs. You know, you're not with a mighty army, and that is extraordinarily dangerous. So that's definitely been something that has shaped my generation of war reporter. This idea that we are very often with the insurgents, and even though Ukraine has kind of changed a lot of that. You know, when I was in Ukraine, I was so struck by how this was the first time I had ever really covered a conventional war. Because, you know, everybody thought conventional war was over, that essentially it would always be non-conventional combats against insurgencies. So it is a conventional war, but the Ukrainians from the very beginning had been so outgunned by the Russians that in some ways it had that that feeling of bands of rebels in the front. That's changing now, of course, because they are so centrally organized and so well equipped by the West. Mm. But most of us cut our teeth, you know, reporting alongside young bands of soldiers and fighters who were really, you know, fighting against the odds.
Mm. And in a sense, there's something very disconcerting about being with them versus those that are clearly destined to be the victors in a conflict. I mean, there is
yeah.
a certain...
Yeah, and I write about that in Syria, mm-hmm. you know, like what it's like to suddenly realize you might be on the losing side today.
Right.
That's very scary.
Yes. Another hallmark of your reporting is that you have not always focused on stories around specifically conflicts and war being waged, but sometimes you have been caught in other kinds of stories. I'm thinking about the humanitarian disaster in Yemen, essentially created by Saudi Arabia, although you talk about America's complicity in that, but covering the way in which so many people's lives were devastated by that, or by the Americans' dramatic and abrupt withdrawal from Afghanistan, covering specifically that kind of story, not specifically about combat as such, but in a sense, mm-hmm. the ancillary costs of conflict. What was it like to try to capture stories like that and of that dimension?
You know, the more I was on the road covering conflicts, the more I was just frustrated by the fact that so much of the coverage focused on the casualty rates of the fighting. And it was just so incredible to me to spend time in these communities, in these countries, whether you're in Afghanistan or Somalia or Yemen, and recognize that the war devastates a nation. You know, it's not about, you know, 15,000 dead on the battlefield, because I will know from spending time in hospitals that actually there's 300,000 dead from malnutrition and preventable diseases because the economy collapsed and the healthcare system collapsed. And, you know, there's so little reporting on that. And I over the years, it became a frustration of mine that, you know, casualty rates were actually what we were reporting to the public only really was the tip of the iceberg. You know, when you look at people who die as an indirect result of the fighting, it is enormous. And I think that if we could communicate the real costs of war, you know, whenever healthcare systems collapse, you know, in Yemen, cholera came back. It hadn't been in the country for so many generations that doctors had never seen it before. You know, in Yemen, you know, hundreds of thousands of people starved and are starving today because people could no longer afford to buy food. And that was as a result of the fact that the war was also being fought along economic lines. It was also an economic blockade. So that just means, like, you know, so it became a part of my job, and I really was passionate about doing this, showing that, like, you know, I told the story of one little girl whose father was a school teacher. The school teacher stopped getting paid, you know, he hadn't been paid in over a year and a half. And, you know, this is a middle-class family by Yemeni standards. I met his daughter. She almost died the day I arrived in a malnutrition ward in rural Yemen. And, you know, so children are not getting enough nutrients, which makes them more susceptible to diseases. And then when they get the diseases, the hospitals are so wildly underfunded and basically on the brink of collapse, they struggle to treat them. So this is a level of detail and nuance that is often missed in news reporting, because it takes time, and you know, it takes more than just sort of scratching the surface of casualty rates. And
absolutely.
So that's something that I was really, really struck by. I lived in Beirut for 6 years. I mean, Lebanon is a country that is so haunted by the war. I mean, by the time I arrived there in 2014, you know, I mean, the war had been over for nearly 25 years. And yet, the impact on the country's ability to actually develop and provide any opportunities for young people was so, so stark. But I felt like the echoes of war throughout the years and what it does to societies and nations and individual families, you know, is so much bigger than what happens on the battlefield.
Right. You write at one point, there are so many more who suffer and die due to the unintended consequences of conflict, the collapse of economies and governments, and with these failures, the chances for any decent public health, sanitation, nutrition, or medical care. I mean, we just don't think about those kind of consequences. I know we have very little time left. I do want to ask you about the fact that you are by no means the first, nor are you going to be the last woman to be a war correspondent. But you, of course, have done this work in some places in which women are viewed a certain way that perhaps put you at a bit of a disadvantage or maybe made some of the work you did even more challenging than it would otherwise be. What do you think is most important for us to understand about this facet of your experience as a war correspondent?
It's a complex subject when it comes to the cultures I'm reporting within, because I'm so often in an extraordinarily privileged position. You know, I get treated often as a bit of a third sex. I say this a lot. You know, it's as I'm kind of a strange creature, and myself and my other female colleagues in the field have all felt this. I think, whereby, you know, we're viewed as a sort of exception sometimes. Yes, we're women, but to many of the people around us, they think we're sort of dressed rather like men. We're sort of doing a man's job in the eyes of many of them, and we're foreigners. And so sometimes, because we're sort of these strange alien creatures to some people, we do get a bit of a pass. I'm always so aware that that gives me an extraordinary privilege over my female colleagues who are journalists in Afghanistan or in Yemen, you know, or in Somalia. That can massively negate the negative impact of it on me. But there's no denying, you know, that there are certain restrictions in very, very conservative societies. If you're really trying to build contacts, you're really trying to, you know, get into to build relationships with men in positions of power, then, you know, that can be tricky. Sometimes it helps me actually access women as well. You know, I get to talk to wives. I get to hang out in beauty parlors filled with Afghan women. I do get into rooms, and I actually wrote about this in the book. I get in with a female camera woman. I brought a female camera woman who was Canadian with me on my last trip to visit the Taliban in Taliban-controlled areas before they took over Kabul. So this was January, February of 2021. And I did that on purpose because we both put burqas on and get through the government checkpoints with our filming equipment buried underneath and hidden underneath our big burqas. So, you know, we were able to sneak around in that way. But when we were in Taliban-controlled areas, there were times when there was one particular moment where we were able to walk into a house. The Taliban fighters can't come in because there are women there. And so it gives me the opportunity to talk to families where I won't have these gunmen breathing down their necks while they're talking. And that's sort of a rare privilege, which is very helpful. But I also talk about this in the book that, you know, people always ask me, what's it like to be a woman in those cultures? And I answer in the same way that you and I are discussing right now, but I always remind them that a lot of the pressures on women in the industry come from back home in the industry. You know, when I was, it's massively improved now. We have a lot of female executives running and helping to run news organizations. But when I was starting out, so many of the news networks were run by men. And so, you know, that's not problematic in and of itself, but that does mean that on camera, you know, women were very much so viewed through that male lens. And so there's pressure. There's pressure to look a certain way. And that is, I would say, in my day-to-day working life, that had more of an impact on me than the fact that I was working in particularly conservative and patriarchal communities.
Interesting. So there's a couple of different ways in which that played out in complicated fashion. And, of course, you also tell us about what was sometimes the unpleasant reality of being a freelancer, not only doing this great work, but not always for a very large paycheck, or probably not even certain about where the next paycheck would come from. So I appreciate the unvarnished honesty with which you share really every facet of this important work, which fortunately has ultimately led to tremendous success and honors, including an Emmy, a Peabody, and a George Polk Award, all richly deserved. Your book again, No Ordinary Assignment, a memoir published by Mariner. Jane Ferguson, thank you so much for your great work as a war correspondent and for giving the world this very important book. And thank you for being my morning show guest. I was honored to speak with you.
Thank you. I really enjoyed that conversation.
You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. For part two of today's program, I'm delighted to share with you an interview that I was thrilled to record back in March, a conversation with Emmy Award-winning actor William Shatner, best known the world over for portraying the role of Captain James T. Kirk in the original Star Trek series and in the films that followed. Also well known for his work with T.J. Hooker, The Practice, Boston Legal, Better Late Than Never, Rescue 911. The occasion of our conversation was William Shatner was about to come to Milwaukee to host a special public screening of the film Star Trek: The Wrath of Khan. Ahead of his visit and ahead of hearing this conversation, here is James Horner's magnificent theme from that film, which is peppered with a quote of the iconic main theme of the original series by Alexander Courage. William Shatner is coming to Milwaukee to be part of that screening and to entertain questions from the audience and to talk about the experience of being James T. Kirk and of making, in particular, this very popular film. William Shatner, we welcome.
Thank you so much. I don't know how unusual what I'm doing, what I will be doing, that perhaps is. I mean, I don't know. I don't follow it, so as far as I'm concerned, I'm the only one doing it. Showing a movie that was very popular, and it's been refurbished, The Wrath of Khan, color and sound and all that kind of thing. And then I'll come out after the movie is over and talk about anything they want to talk about, the audience wants to talk about, whether it's about the movie and how we made it, what we did, other things that are of interest. And spend an hour to an hour and a half with the audience, having fun with the audience. It's very unusual. It's a great evening in the theater. And strangely, and you'll have to help me solve this, Greg, is I'm going to four cities that weekend, this coming weekend. I will be in Atlanta, in Indianapolis, in Detroit, and Milwaukee. Everywhere else is just about sold out. Very few tickets left. Somehow, in Milwaukee, we've got many tickets available. And we don't know why tickets are slow to go in Milwaukee uniquely. It's a wonderful show, so I urge your listening audience to come to the theater on Friday night. It's going to be great fun.
For no doubt, and I have a feeling that what you just described is not going to be true much longer. I want to ask you, first of all, how different was it making the films, that is, those six original series motion pictures, versus making the television series itself many years ago? Of course, it was a completely different schedule, and lots of other things were different. How different did it feel to you and your fellow actors?
Well, making a movie is lethargic by comparison to doing television. Television, you have to do 10 pages a day of dialogue. So there's an awful lot of words that have to be learned to be said. Movies are made in setups. Camera moves in a direction, takes a picture of you, may then cut. You move the camera back. It's a wide shot. It's a two shot. It's a three shot. Time is taken to get a variety of shots, but not on television, because moving that camera around takes time, and time is limited because you've got to get those 10 pages in, whereas in a movie, you might just get the one shot, and that's it, folks. Let's wrap. We'll come meet tomorrow. So the pace of a movie and the pace of a television show is extravagantly different.
Which was more fun for you, maybe I should ask two questions. Which was more fun, which was more satisfying to you as an actor, making the series or making these motion pictures? Or is it difficult to judge?
The same thing applies. For me, the same thing applies. You might be able to do a take. I was on a stage where the actress had to say no. She was in close-up. And they did it 30 times. Now, I can't explain to you why the first no wasn't satisfactory to the director, as was that the 30th no became either satisfactory or he gave up. But you don't have that kind of time in television. Say no, no, okay, wrap, let's go. There's more time to fashion your performance. So if it takes 30 no's to get the no, then you take that time according, you know, if that's what satisfies the director. Whereas in television, just get the word out. Say no, good, wrap, let's go. and that's not an exaggeration.
Wow.
But there's an excitement to it. That kind of speed, you've got to be up to speed. So you've got to rehearse yourself, and you've got to be there. And so the adrenaline is flowing. So you might get something else, something better, something different than pondering, how am I going to say no today?
Right. And, of course, you know, one of the great wonders of that original series is that on that tight schedule and with an increasingly tight budget, the best episodes of that series are some of the best television ever made and, of course, endure to this very day. It's a show I've loved for 50 years now.
Thank you for saying that. And you're absolutely right. The stories that the reason that the Wrath of Khan has survived all these years, in my opinion, is it tells a beautiful story. It's an emotional, evocative story. And that was the best of Star Trek. And no matter how little our budgets were and how fast we had to move, if the writer, who is the most important part of anything, let alone on television, the story you're telling is the important part of it. And how many bad performers and bad directors survived a wonderful script because it wasn't anything they did. It was the power of the words and the power of the story.
Power of the story. Absolutely.
And vice versa, of course, it works the other way around. No matter how talented the director and actors were, if you're telling a terrible story, it's not going to work either.
Speaking of talented actors, of course, in addition to the entire original cast that was assembled, including, of course, you, Leonard Nimoy, DeForest Kelly, and all the rest, this film was also notable for the return of one Ricardo Montalban in the role of Khan. You have many exchanges with him in this terrific film. I don't remember that you were ever physically in the same room. I wonder, what was exactly your encounter with him?
Years later, I recall all these years later, somebody said that to me, and I thought, you know, you're right. It didn't occur to me that he was that the two of us weren't on screen together, because we became really good friends a little bit before that time, and making the film, and then afterwards, we had become really wonderful acquaintances. That it didn't occur to me that I didn't have a scene with him, but it was pointed out, you know, you're never on screen with him. We have exchanges, but never together at the same time.
Never. You two were never in the same room in terms of on camera, but of course, close collaborators, and there is a very special chemistry between the two of you. And of course, spoiler alert to our listeners, one of the most notable scenes in this film is where Leonard Nimoy's character, Mr. Spock, perishes in the act of selflessly saving the ship and its crew. What was it like to perform that death scene? And at the time, did you know that that was a death that was not going to be permanent? I mean, in the moment, did you think you were saying goodbye forever to the character of Spock?
I was astonished when the producer said, we're going to kill Spock. And I said, are you crazy? You know, whatever. I ranted and raved, no, we're going to kill Spock. I didn't know that my dear friend Leonard and the producers had concocted this idea because, and this is how clever Leonard was, he said, I'm tired of playing Spock. Unless I can direct Star Trek III, the next film after this one that we're showing at the theater, unless I can direct it, I'm not going to play it anymore. And he forced the studio to allow him to direct, which then allowed me to direct one of the Star Trek films. So it was planned, and I didn't know it.
Hmm. Well, it's an amazing scene, just one of many amazing scenes in this terrific movie. And I imagine you are excited about the possibility of people being able to see this once again on the big screen.
It's a delight. It's a great evening in the theater. With this refurbished film, color and sound on the big screen, and then I come out afterwards and try my best to entertain the audience. And in those hours, it's a very special evening.
Mm, no doubt. And William Shatner, thank you so much for all you've given the world, and best wishes and safe travels to Milwaukee.
Thank you so much. I look forward to being there.
The preceding interview with William Shatner was recorded and initially broadcast back in March of 2023. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, another favorite interview from 2023, Luke Nichter, the author of The Year That Broke Politics, a look back at 1968. On Wednesday, The Rise of the Black Quarterback with author Jason Reed. On Thursday,